I am a human being and I killed human beings.
Before I knew it, I'd fired 4 shots at the door. I kept on shouting for Reva to phone the police.
Tests are underway to determine if a serial killer is on the loose in Centurion, Pretoria.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
In a country marked by the harsh reality of 84 daily murders, these are the stories that echo through the reality of life in South Africa. Hello, it's Paul Llewellyn, and I'm delving into the minds of Africa's most evil. What drives them to commit unspeakable acts, and what does it take to bring them to justice? Leading the way on our journey is Gerard Labuschagne, an author, former law enforcement officer, and current head of LNS Threat Management. Labuschagne helmed the investigative psychology section of the South African Police Service from 2001 to 2016, working on over 300 cases of serial murder and rape. He's an internationally recognized and renowned expert in forensic psychology, and he is our profiler. Spread the word about the show. Share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone interested in crime in Africa. Please do share. Visit us at youtube.com/c/profilerAfrica, and please do subscribe to the channel there. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. And others, just search for Profiler Africa, follow us on Instagram at Profiler Africa, join our Facebook group, or drop us an email at profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. Do go and check out our social media pages. We sometimes post images and information related to the crime that we're discussing. So while you're listening to the podcast, you can check out some of the crime scene photographs, for example. And we do have, we've got tons of stuff on the case that we'll be discussing today, so we'll put up a few things. So welcome to another episode of Profiler. Today we revisit a tragic incident that unfolded at the Rosebank Police Station in Johannesburg back in 2011. So we're going back in time on today's episode to discuss a historic case, and one that was really kind of rocked the city of Johannesburg at the time that it happened. And if you know Rosebank, which is obviously a very upmarket, middle-class suburb, it's not typically the type of thing that you expect to happen at the Rosebank Police Station. So we'll unpack what happened with that case and discuss some of the repercussions of it also. But first of all, Gerard, what I would like to do is set the scene for folks who are maybe not entirely familiar with how policing in South Africa is structured. Let's get to kind of how a police station fits into the bigger system. Break down for first of all, hi.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Okay.
Are you well?
I am.
I'm so enthusiastic to get into the Rosebank Police Station.
I know, and you today. Love doing the introduction live every single time.
Oh, you think I should just pre-record it and we just tag in, slap it on the beginning of each episode? Today, my voice, every day your voice has a unique level of gruffness depending on how stressful yesterday was. So I'd hate for, like, 3 months ago, much happier, more kind of enlightened Paul's voice to clash with today's more cynical April Paul's voice.
Okie dokes.
You know? Okay, fine. All right, Gerard. So please, just break down for us. You work there. How do the police work?
So I think this is quite interesting from the point of view if you're used to watching like American television or documentaries about American TV shows. A police service develops with the background of the history of that particular country. You know, America had its own development, you know, et cetera. We had our own. But essentially, we only have one law enforcement agency. Our constitution actually technically only allows one law enforcement agency, the South African Police Service nowadays. Pre-94, it was sort of the South African Police, to actually be responsible for investigating crime in the country. So we don't have, like in the U.S., there's literally like, I think, 17,000 independent law enforcement agencies. So you could, for example, travel from Hillbrow Police Station to Rosebank Police Station, and it's a completely different police service. They have their own uniforms, they hire their own people, they have their own rules and regulations, they use their own forensics people, but it's really completely independent. And once you're outside of your little jurisdiction, because you're no longer a law enforcement officer.
This kind of, in America, this kind of grew out of kind of small town sheriff kind of
decentralization
vibe.
Of power is really what it was about, because, you know, the modern American history, but taking aside the sort of obviously who was originally there, the First Nation people, you know, when sort of people came from Europe, you know, they set up a place, then the UK came over and basically colonized it, and then those people said, we don't want that, and that led to that first war, I think, First War of Independence, I think it was, excuse my dodgy American history, where they kind of kicked out colonial rule, and then everybody was very much independent. This is our, we don't want anybody else above us telling us what to do. So that became that your power was decentralized to like your local sheriff became like the law enforcement. And it's only with more modern step forward in modern America, the states working together after the Civil War, you know, that they had more of a federal overarching system. So essentially, those are all private little independent. You've got local police departments. Then you've got state, you know, because the U.S. is divided into 50 states, a state law enforcement agency. And then, of course, the federal law enforcement agency, which works across the borders. So it's really
which
different
is, of course,
tiers.
The FBI.
Yeah. So literally, I mean, you can have it where, you know, you've got, if you assault someone on a city park or a national park, it's the park police whose jurisdiction it is to investigate that. But if you then run across the road and you go on to, you know, the lawn of the White House, that's a different law enforcement agency who's going to investigate that. And then if you run across into a suburb and commit a further crime, it's another law enforcement agency. And if you get in the highway, it's a different law enforcement agency. So coordination across these can be very complicated, like in serial murder cases where you have someone operating. So we don't have that history, and how we basically develop it, we have one law enforcement agency throughout the country. So whether I am based in Johannesburg and I travel down to Cape Town to look for, hunt for and arrest a suspect, I'm a policeman there as much as I am a policeman here. Yes, you break it down for management purposes into little individual police stations, and every area is covered by a police station in South Africa. And then often what they do nowadays, or even previously, is they group them into what we used to call districts, we now call clusters. So anything from 5 to 10 police stations can be grouped under one cluster, which would have a cluster head, which is typically going to be a general, who technically is are responsible for those stations underneath him or her. And then, of course, those clusters all get grouped into a province according to the provincial boundaries. And you have a provincial head of police who's responsible for policing. But it's still all one law enforcement agency. We have one set of laws that we are enforcing. Our internal regulations and guidelines and national instructions are applicable throughout the country. So, you know, in Gauteng, you know, the crime scene people can't decide that they want to process crime scenes in this way, and Cape Town will do it that way. There is a national instruction of how all things are done. So it makes it a very large. I mean, comparatively, we're a huge law enforcement agency compared to the majority in the U.S. Because I think I'm trying to find the most accurate stats. We have like 150,000 people, if I'm talking under correction. Whereas, you know, you can go to a police station in the States and you've got 5 people. So it's a massive organization compared to almost all across the world. We're very big. Certain advantages because, you know, in terms of buying power, you know, if you're a little police department in the States and you want to buy a crime scene light sources, you're buying one or two. When SAPS buys those very same thing, you're buying 500. So, you know, in terms of bargaining power, buying power, you know, which is why we also have a lot of things that little police stations don't have. I mean, phenomenal forensic laboratory in Cape Town is like really, really super modern. One of the biggest in the world, you know, very high tech, etc. You know, a little PD can't afford that because they just don't have the money from the local city council to buy and invest. So there are advantages of having massive, big organizations. I guess there's some other ones of having smaller organizations.
Where did we inherit our system from? Is this kind of, is this a, how it works in the UK? Is it kind of a colonial inheritance?
I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure exactly. I think the UK, I think it's less this you're independent, you know.
Because yeah, that's also separate.
It's divided in constabularies for this area, but I think in the UK you're still a cop whether you leave your little assigned area. You would, I think, still be law enforcement officer anywhere in the UK. So I'm not, again, talking under correction. I think it's just really how things...
I guess for kind of an apartheid state, for example, having one strong, controlled, centralized police service is very much aligned to is the best option as far as meeting your objectives.
Look, let me put it this way: I think if you're going to be a tyrannical organization, autocratic organization, you don't want independent.
You want it centralized.
You want centralized. Yeah. That's very much, I mean, in how I'd imagine autocratic states. So that doesn't mean, you know, that's the nature of this police, but. Definitely, you don't want independent free thinkers And I think that's partly why the U.S. had that way of developing, that we're not going to have an autocratic huge organization that oppresses individual people.
What's interesting is the challenge in that, you know, maybe when it comes to how democratic the system feels, centralized would imply that maybe there's kind of more risk there, kind of compromising those values. That said, centralized is more effective when it comes to actual policing, because you've got one group that is kind of aligned on solving a particular crime or tackling a particular challenge. Mm. And then, so anyone that's brought into that investigation then would become part of that, is essentially already a part of the same team.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, we've got about 1,150 police stations throughout the country that cover every part of the country. I think I was looking now some facts and figures. We've got about 117,000 police officers, although that term isn't quite correct in South Africa, and about 52,000 civilians who would be doing more of the administrative stuff.
Okay. Now, let's then kind of get to a police station itself. Who typically are the personnel that would man a police station? Who are the kind of key essential personnel? What kind of team would you find at a typical police station like, and let's talk about a typical suburban police station like Rosebank?
I guess the biggest way to divide it would be that you'd have your people doing visible policing, because that's the guys driving around the vans, walking around in uniforms, trying to visibly prevent crimes by being present, and then responding when there's a call. You know, hey, I'm being robbed, or hey, my house is broken into. A van would come out, take the statements, et cetera, et cetera. Then the second part of that, which would be your detectives, who then investigate the crime thereafter.
There's another cycle race this week around the parks. So the eighth cycle race this week that the police need to be deployed to.
That kind of stuff. So they'll be divided between your visible policing people and your detectives. That's really the biggest chunk of, and then you've got your admin people, your HR, clerks, typing this, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what level of rank would be managing that police station depends on how big it is. You know, sadly, I mean, if you look at it, we've got about almost 200, just under shy of 200 generals. I mean, I think pre-apartheid, I think we had 9 generals. We now have more than the British Army had, I once read somewhere. More generals now than the British Army had at the end of World War II.
You've said this before, but didn't you mention it as the kind of combined Allied forces?
Something like that. It was phenomenal. Yeah. So, and why that is, I don't know. So we now have police stations.
Well, you have your suspicion. I mean, a general gets paid more than...
Oh my God, you get a big salary.
Is it not that? Is it like...
I guess you could say rewarding more people. So now, for example, you used to get a police station that was run by a warrant officer, which is like sort of the third, fourth level up from a constable. I mean, like I said, in the old days, you would have only a province maybe run by a general. Hmm. Now you have a big police station run by a general. It's like ridiculous.
And what is a general's role?
Essentially, they are incredibly senior managers. Once you reach general levels, you are running the police.
Okay.
You get like your divisional commissioner, lieutenant generals, then you get sort of major generals. That's really the top structure, the top echelon of the police. Is that right?
Well, I mean, having a lot would imply then maybe devaluing that role a little bit.
Absolutely. The colonel used to be incredibly senior rank. Now it's not really that. I mean, we've got like over 2,500 colonels.
2,500 colonels?
Full colonels. About 6,000 lieutenant colonels. Yeah.
Sure.
So we're massively top heavy in terms of our senior ranks.
It just immediately makes me think what the salary bill then is. Because I know that the biggest, it's not surprising, but the biggest chunk of police budget goes to salaries. So I can imagine that is therefore a lot bigger than it need be. Mm. If historically we've run the police with much fewer senior management, it just seems like, it feels like, is there an unnecessary amount of expenditure going on there? So typical, feels kind of normal and typical and very South African for these days, doesn't it?
Yeah. So essentially, yeah. So the police commissioner of a police station commissioner would be in charge of policing in his or her area. They would have certain targets that they have to meet. Stats becomes a very important thing, which is why we then get people fiddling statistics to make their crime look better, because we are chasing statistics, sadly, in terms of our policing. So you'll get people who attempted murder docket gets opened up as an assault docket, because assault is a lot less severe. Now, that doesn't mean you would investigate it any differently, and still the prosecutor at the end of the day can charge the person with attempted murder. But on your stats, you'll say we had less attempted murders than, say, last year.
Yeah.
Instead of opening up a murder docket, you open up an inquest docket. An inquest docket is typically for something like a suicide, or when you're not quite sure, it doesn't look like a murder, so you open up, like a guy falls off the roof, you open up an inquest docket. It still can be investigated, and you can still arrest someone and charge them with murder, but on the stats it says not a murder.
Yes.
And that we've countless times we find, because people are being pressured to meet statistical goals as opposed to actual real policing goals, in my opinion.
Yeah. And even with all that effort, the crime statistics that come out every year are awful, aren't they?
Yeah.
So it's
even with all the fiddling, they're terrible.
Even with all the fiddling, they're terrible. You know what I mean? They've stripped it down as kind of lower, you know, to make it as pleasant kind of seeming as they can. But still worst in the world kind of statistics that you land on. In a city like Johannesburg, there is also this entity called the Metro Police.
Yeah. Well,
how do the Metro Police fit in?
I'm not quite sure.
What are the Metro Police?
How they fit in terms legally. I mean, obviously, there must have been looked into whether that is not contrary to the Constitution. But sort of your Durban, JMPD, Durban Metro, Cape Town, they're really there enforcing bylaws. You know, if you're trading on the streets, you know, they'll come and check, do you have a little permit to do so? They're not there to respond to, hey, someone's breaking into my house. They could, if they hear about it, of course. And if they see a crime, yes, part of their job will be to respond to it. But they're not tasked with the role, really, of investigating an incident that takes place, responding like on 10111, it always goes to the South African police. If a crime is discovered, the police, SAPS, has to come over, then, you know, take statements, investigate it, take someone to court, prosecute, etc. So I don't quite know how they fit into the structure. I think there was talk about should they bring them into the SAPS's structure or not. I don't know. I do think that there's some merit in that the city mayor has, because those fall under the mayor, really, as far as I understand, can task them to do certain things and focus on certain things.
And traffic?
Same with traffic. I mean, again, I'm not quite sure from a legal perspective, but they don't fall under the South African police. So you get the national, you know, you get road RTI, and then you get the national traffic. So you could see these guys drive past with cars that look a little bit different. And again, but their responsibility would be more aimed at traffic-related issues. If a crime occurred, they'd have to call out the SAPS to take it further.
Now, we also took a recent little excursion, you and I, to see the judgment, to attend the judgment for the Sifiso Mkhwanazi case. And there were some other uniformed folks there that I'd not seen before. And you'd mentioned that they were called community safety wardens or Gauteng safety wardens or something like that. Do you have a sense of what is that now as well?
So this seems to be something that so far has only happened in Gauteng. They wear kind of green uniforms with, I think, berets, and they have little bulletproof vests. You know, they're kind of like to be eyes and ears in the community, I guess, to help reduce crime by having some kind of a law enforcement looking presence. So out there is the deterrent factor. They're not armed, so you know that they wouldn't be running towards an armed robbery or something. You know, they work alongside their police, community patrollers, schools to reduce crime, corruption, vandalism. That's kind of like their kind of main task. But I don't really know. I mean, I guess they're like one step above security guards in the sense that they patrol around. And
in the course of working in the kind of true crime space, I've come across a number of folks who've spoken about the fact that what is happening at the moment is that a lot of policing is being essentially handed to private security. Is this kind of an aspect of that? And is that a reality? Are we seeing that because the police is becoming more and more dysfunctional, instead of trying to fix the problem, they're kind of passing it off to our local security firms that we're seeing, and kind of shifting the balance of power a little bit?
I guess this is a way, because I guess you're paying these people a lot less. They don't have the same arrest powers as just in normal police officers. If anybody's offended by that, I'm sorry. They can assist law enforcement, preserve a crime scene until the police arrive. So I guess it's a way of, with less money, having more boots on the ground, hopefully having a preventative role, and assisting to some degree when something does happen.
Yeah.
How good this is going to be, and the time will tell. If it works, that's fantastic. If it doesn't, it's a big fat waste of money. We've employed 3,000 people. Then what are we going to do with them?
Yeah. It says here they're tasked with patrolling high-risk areas, deterring criminal activity, assisting law enforcement agencies, and promoting a sense of safety within their assigned communities. And I'm sure that, you know, you say that they don't have the same. I'm sure that's not how they behave.
Yeah, look, I mean, I wonder how seriously the community would take this. If I saw one of these people trying to tell me what to do, depending what I'm doing, I don't know whether I'd...
Unless you're kind of caught climbing in through the window of someone's house.
Kind of, you know, I don't know whether they want to pull me over and search me, I don't think they have the powers to do.
Sure.
I just don't know how much... Would people just see them as, you're really nothing more than a security guard, bugger off?
Yeah.
So again, the proof will be in the pudding. The proof is in the taste of the eating, the pudding, whatever that saying is going.
The proof of the pudding is in the eating.
If they work, it's fantastic. I just have my serious concerns about whether it's going
to
work.
Yeah. Now, let's get back then to the experience of a police station. So we've spoken a little bit about how the structure works.
Yeah.
We've obviously, over the course of the podcast, discussed a lot of the challenges that the police confront. And that the public confront in dealing with the police. Let's unpack that a little bit. Although I'm not trying to be too leading, let's talk about what a police, you know, what you as the general public, how you would engage with a police station, because there's also a kind of a customer service component to policing that you can walk into your local police station, whether it's to get to report a car accident or a crime or to get a document, stamped.
Yeah.
What is this experience typically like? Set the scene a little bit for people. What it's like dealing with a police station and interacting with that environment.
Look, I think most people's contact with the police would be when they go to a police station, like you say, to get a document certified as a true copy, to give an affidavit for a job application, or to report a crime. So the average person's experience when you walk into that charge office or community service center, as we now call it. And, you know, sadly, you can get such a wide range of experience. You know, I must say that I sometimes have to go to Parkview Police Station in Johannesburg. And at least when I walk in there, I usually get a friendly greeting, which is a good way to start off. And so I must say, Parkview, polite people. But I think the majority of people's experiences, and people are welcome to post on whatever platform this is, it's like, I mean, I kind of dread even going to any police station, to be honest with you, whether to have something certified. I just kind of like sigh and walk in and don't expect much and just hope I get in and out of there relatively quickly. Mm. And that's sadly where we fall flat. You mentioned customer service. And like I went to the other police station the other day to get something printed out for, I won't say what it was approved. And they said, oh, sorry, we don't have toner in our printer. I said, ooh, not possible you can print this out on one of the other printers. No, we can't do that. But you can go to another police station and get that thing printed out. Just tell them that there wasn't ink here. I said, okay, can I go to this particular, actually Rosebank, can I go to Rosebank Police Station? And yeah, you can go to Rosebank Police Station. So I go to Rosebank Police Station, find the person who deals with these issues. I said, hi, I was just at Parkview and they said this, and they don't have ink, can I print? Oh no, that person's supposed to give me confirmation before I can print for you. I'm like, well, that person didn't tell me that. And she clearly didn't contact the person. Even if she knew it, she didn't contact him. And now we're trying to get hold of that person, and we can't get hold of them.
No, it's giving me anxiety.
And then it's kind of like, you know, bugger you. And, you know, and it's like, and as another police station said to me, I know this particular person, said, like, what about service delivery? Mm. You know, did that person make any effort? Let me just phone. Let me check. Okay, I know that's often an issue. Let me print this out for you. It's something you're entitled to anyway, you know. So why not?
You went through police training.
Yeah.
What is, you know, tell us about the month-long customer service course that you went through as a
such a thing. And again, it was renamed as Delivering Police Service after 1994 at some point, because it's about actually delivering a service. And yes, you can get amazing people, individuals who really do want to help you. They might be limited with their resources, and you might even get an amazing station in general. But that's not the overall experience. And I always say to people, it's like if you want to judge Toyota as a brand, if they make 1,000 cars a year, just for argument's sake, keep the math simple for me, if they make 1,000 cars a year and 990 are crap and break down and fall apart, but 10 are amazing and run forever, how do you judge them? On the 10 or the other 990 that were terrible? You're going to judge them on the nine as a brand on the 990. Yeah. And as a brand, Seps, and I've said this in court before, it's like no credibility. I'm sorry. Not barring that you're going to get some amazing individuals.
Yeah.
And maybe here and there an amazing station because there's great management. But that is not the norm. And you have absolutely. To judge the organization by the norm.
Look, I mean, sad to say, but when it comes to parenting, my advice is when it comes to the police, or my approach is, if you don't have to speak to the police, just avoid them. Do not talk to the police if you don't have to. The objective is, when you're kind of going through your general life in South Africa, if you don't have to talk to the police, if there's any other way to resolve your issue, take that route first.
Mm.
And try not to engage with a law enforcement officer. Just because, like any typical resident of this city, the vast majority of my interactions with the police have been negative.
Mm.
And I'm not the kind of person who, I was pulled over once back in the day for maybe being a little bit over the limit and driving. This is like 50.
Speed limit or alcohol limit?
Yeah. One of them. And, my approach to that is immediately just to arrest myself. I'm like, I did it. Arrest. I'm not somebody who pushes back in that kind of environment to start with. But even then, you can very quickly find yourself in a whole lot of trouble.
Mm.
I had an incident with my ex-wife. I got a call one Saturday morning. It was about 11 o'clock. Her and her brother were driving around in Soweto by Jabulani area. And I get this panicked phone call. I've been stopped by the police. I need you, drive to where I am. Send me a location. I immediately jump in the car. Now, she's about 45, 50 minutes away from our house. So I have to drive. I get there. Now, this is a black woman and her brother, okay? And they are in their area, in the area where they were raised, the familia, and driving a nice car. Her brother's an Uber driver, so he's driving a very nice car. And apparently they'd pulled up at a stop street, and as far as they're concerned, they'd stopped and then pulled over, and then police had spotted them and pulled them over, saying, "You didn't stop at the stop street." Her brother's driving, jumps out the car immediately. The police attempt to solicit a bribe. My ex, who's very anti that kind of stuff, "No, we're not doing any of that. It's nonsense." Immediately wants to kind of get their badge numbers, who they are, what their names are, and they refuse. They're covering their badges, etc. She then goes to take a photograph of the license plate number, and they then try to pull her out of her car. So she closes herself in the car. It's summer. This is like December. It's probably about 35 degrees out. It's a hot, it's middle of the day already. I arrive here now. So I arrive to the scene. This is what's just happened, okay? I arrive to the scene. There must be 7 police cars parked around them, okay? Maybe 20 police officers standing around. My ex in the car, she's locked herself in the car with all the windows closed up. She's refusing to get out. Again, because these guys are trying to drag her out of the car. Her brother's outside of the car. I discuss, I'm like, "Guys, okay, what can we do to resolve this? This is my wife, and we're trying to, can we just carry on with our days? I'm sure, they haven't broken any serious laws that it requires 6 police cars and 20 cops to be here. Can we just take a little drive up the road to the police station, resolve the matter, and everyone can go about their day? No problem, let's do that, blah, blah, blah." Bearing in mind that we'd agree to go to the police station to discuss and resolve the matter. We go to the police station. I tell you, as soon as she put her foot in the front door of the police station, they grab her and drag her into the back. Her brother loses it and is trying to box the police. So I'm trying to kind of pull him off the police. And then it's a bit chaotic, to be honest with you. But she gets dragged and taken then back, carried literally back into the police cells. Now, she then immediately finds herself in a cell, having her phone taken off her by the original two cops that had pulled her over and attempted to solicit a bribe from her. She's alone in a police cell. Nobody wants to say what she's being charged with, why she's being arrested. This is Saturday, you know, so she's also looking at being locked up until Monday when there's a judge available. Fortunately, knew one or two people, managed to get a colonel to come down to the police station and get her out that evening. Had we not, though, you know, had we not had some little back door to solve the problem, essentially what you've got here is somebody who's been stripped of their rights, thrown into a police cell in a threatening situation with the two police that were attempting to bribe her in the first place, you know, attempting to bribe them in the first place, and the potential of being there exposed to that for the rest of the weekend. Mm. You know, and this is a young woman who is just, you know, who's upwardly mobile, got a nice job, drives a nice car, got a little family, you know, just going about her business on a Saturday morning, and suddenly, because they so apparently didn't stop at a stop street, finds themselves thrown in a police cell. You know, it often makes me think, you know, what's the difference between that and being dragged out of your bed at 3 o'clock in the morning?
That's the same.
You know,
abuse
it's the
of
same
power.
Kind of thing, abuse of power. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I feel like everyone has that kind of, too many people have that kind of story in relation to the police, don't they?
Mm.
Sorry to go off on a bit of a tangent and tell that story. But again, I think for listeners, it's the kind of thing that can very easily still happen here, because you do get a sense that as soon as that badge gets put on, a lot of South Africans who have been maybe disempowered for a lot of their life, or you know, suddenly that badge gives them a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem that the South African police are very much aware of how far they can push it once that badge is on their chest.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, policing is just open to abuse. That's as simple as that. If you have the wrong kind of people in those jobs, you have, like you say, a lot of power. Because all you do is now your buddies will all say, no, you were screaming, fighting, you were resisting arrest, you got five people giving statements against you and your brother.
Let's get on to our case now. So we've kind of got a sense of the police system, how it's structured, how it works, a little bit of what it's like to engage with the police for a lot of people. There obviously are positives, but I, like you say, I think the overall brand of SAPS is not great, due large in part to their own behavior. Let's get down to our incident now. So we've got a clerk who ends up being very disgruntled. Who was he, and what happened here, Gerard?
So right, so let's start right at the beginning. And essentially what you have taking place is, in the SAPS, there's telephones in the offices, right? And what'll often happen is you, Paul, will be allocated a code that if you want to make a phone call from your office phone or any phone in the police station, you first punch in your personal code that only you are supposed to know, and then you will get an open line and you make a call. So that at the end of the month, people can then say, right, here's your bill for your phone. Indicate which ones were official calls and you won't pay for those. And of course, if you've made other calls that are private in nature, you will then have to pay that amount of money. So everybody gets allocated, it's like a secret PIN code. Now, at this particular office, what had happened is that two admin people working in our suspect, Mr. Kakana, and I think the other, off the top of my head, I can't remember the other guy's name, we'll get it now, were charged with essentially having made phone calls using a particular Captain Siddique's PIN code. Because he suddenly gets this bill, and it's like, hang on a minute, like this is like, whoa, I didn't make all these calls, and he does his own little investigation and very quickly realizes, okay, these two guys were making phone calls and using that particular number. And these two admin guys sat in the same office together. So very quickly, so through some basic investigation, it was
Satoli
determined.
Satoli was his.
Was the other one Satoli?
Yeah, Kekana and Satoli.
So essentially that kind of gets uncovered, you know, this is now October 2010, you know, that this is uncovered. And he quickly, as I said, realizes who they were and confronts them. And they kind of, I think, kind of both immediately say, yes, we can't, you know, we're sorry we did it, etc. But unfortunately, that's fraud because, A, you're stealing because you're not paying for the calls that you should have been paid for. And, you know, making Captain Siddiqui now have to pay them if he wasn't smart enough, quickly enough to realize, hang on, there's a problem here. So that's essentially fraud. And, you know, police is an organization that's based on trust and proper behavior. And you're committing fraud.
The least sensible place to do fraud is in a police station, or one of, at least.
So essentially, I do think criminal cases were open, but also then, of course, internal disciplinary proceedings. And it would then fell upon Captain Naidu, who was the HR person at Rosebank Police Station.
The head of support services.
Yeah, to basically institute the disciplinary process. And that's really what takes place. I mean, as I said, the guys pretty much admitted that they had done it, Tall and Kakana. They couldn't remember where they got the number from. You know, but they both sat in the same office, etc. So, long story short, they were essentially, and the, you know, the amount of money that they actually owed was like, I think Kakana owed like 450 rand. You know, not lie. But unfortunately, it's not about the amount of money; it's about the principle. You committed fraud. We're a police organization, etc.
Yeah.
So, make a long story short, it goes through the disciplinary process, and the recommendation is that they are to be dismissed.
Now, prior to the disciplinary hearing, Naidu had already been receiving threatening messages from these guys as well. So they admitted their guilt on the 19th of October, and then the 25th of October, they're getting she's getting messages. You messed my life. Better be careful. You leave your kids alone. You try to be a hero even where it doesn't concern you. I'll F you.
Yep.
And then another one insulting. Here's a fake captain. Insulting her heart, insulting her racially. So really having a go at it. This is prior to the disciplinary hearing in 2011.
This is like the first one, you know, Siddiqui realizes there's a problem with his phone accounts like the 4th of October. By the 25th of October, the first message, you know, you better be careful, you're leaving your kids alone, I'll F you, etc. was 25th of October, and then sort of 30th, and then the 3rd of November, 8th of November. And that does lead to an
arrest.
It leads to a docket being opened up, intimidation docket, which, quite frankly, I looked at that docket. So the intimidation docket was opened up in October of 2010. I'm trying to see the exact date it was opened up. But I looked at that docket, and quite frankly, nothing was really done. You know, I see there was a request to section 205 warrant, subpoena for information from Vodacom, but there's no evidence that that was actually obtained, and the source number that those SMSs were sent from, the handset that was used, etc. It really doesn't seem like actually anything was done about it. And I mean, I can promise you now, an intimidation docket at the SAPS, which is opened up, if you were a civilian and you opened up something like this, honestly, I don't think this is going to get anything, if at all, much attention.
Yeah.
You'd like to think that this is your colleague now at the station who's been threatened. You would want to put a lot of effort into it.
Exactly.
But honestly, it looks like nothing else was really done.
Would these guys have been suspended at the time? Would they then have been removed, let go?
I'm not too sure exactly. I think they were at a point suspended, but I don't know at what point.
Okay.
Now, the problem is you have threats being made, and you're very sure that these threats are related to this action. So even, and this is the problem where police will look at it as, well, at this point we don't have evidence, so we can't arrest them for this. But you have to look at it from a threat point of view.
Yeah.
You know, from a threat point of view, as a threat assessment manager, threat manager, which is what I've been doing for the past, you know, 8 years, we would say there's a concern for the safety. And law enforcement say, well, we haven't yet proved it's conclusively that person's like, as a threat manager, say, I don't care. If we have a good reasonable suspicion, it's not even about who it is. We have a threat received. Do we have a threat received? Yes. Okay, so there's a concern for the safety. The fact that we haven't yet established who it is in a way kind of irrelevant, because we get a lot of anonymous threats.
Yeah.
And we can't say, well, we're not going to do anything until we know who the threat is, No. Mm. As a threat assessor, we have received a threat. Mm. There's things going on in the background of this person's work which could link to that. Therefore, we have to treat this credibly. But police only think in terms of investigation, not in terms of threat management and keeping people safe. I know that sounds ironic, but that's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
So there wasn't, in my opinion, a proper, adequate response to keeping this individual safe.
And thinking in terms of investigation means, can I, in the context of my greater workload, bring this thing to a resolution fairly efficiently and easily, kind of thing.
Yeah. And this, you know, this was an easy case. Got to tell you how I would solve it. Yes, the person did apply, did the statement to apply for a Section 205 from Vodacom to find out, do we have an any ID linked to that phone number? Because remember, you can't hide your number when you're sending an SMS.
Yeah.
You can hide your number in terms of the call you're making that it shows up no caller ID or something like that. Mm. But that doesn't mean on this Vodacom system there's no evidence of that call and who it was made by. But here we have SMSs, so we've got that number. So then we would say, right, is this number linked to a particular person because of RICA? And secondly, which handset is it linked to? Because we can ask Vodacom, you know, and they'll tell you this is an Apple iPhone with this serial number. You know, then you can go to the person you think is most likely sending this and say, I want, you know, hand over your phone and check the serial number. It's like, sorry, sunshine, these calls emanated from your phone. Boom.
Yeah.
There's your case solved. That's exactly all you need to do with this case. And it doesn't look like it was done.
And it's one of our own. So like you say, you'd think it would go right to the top of the list.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, a disciplinary hearing is held. I mean, the disciplinary only happens, 7-8 months later?
Yeah.
July, the disciplinary hearing is held in 2011. And the outcome of that disciplinary hearing is that Kekana's dismissal is sanctioned and he is informed of the dismissal on the 19th of July, 2011. What happens then?
So, yeah, so that's 19th of July. It's quite a bit, you know, down the line.
Was there more stuff that happened in between that that we need to talk about?
No, look, as far as I know, it was just Naidu getting those threats and one of the other people in this police station seemed to be implying that person was having an affair with the station commissioner, Colonel McKeezy.
Oh.
So there were two people actually that received threatening communications in that docket that was opened up for intimidation. So he's informed of the dismissal. Like I said, by that point, they had... I'm trying to think if it was suspended already. But definitely from that point where they decide to dismiss, you know, they do then get the safe keys. Now, I don't know why a civilian had key access to the armory.
Yes.
I don't think that's policy. And I'm very surprised. Anyway. But one of Kakana's jobs was taking firearms to the provincial armory for repairs. And earlier that year, I think in March of 2011, he had booked in a firearm for repairs at the provincial armory. He had been notified a while back that it was ready for collection, but he hadn't. So now we fast forward and we have the disciplinary hearing. The process is recommended that he be dismissed. I think it still has to get the final okay by the provincial commissioner. He's informed of that on the 19th. 26th of July, they hand over the keys to Captain Stain, who I think was one of the crime prevention captains, and the lock is replaced. But now on the date, I think he's contacted again by the armory to say, listen, you haven't picked up this gun. Now, probably what happens is, because of his low level as an admin clerk, he wouldn't have had a work cell phone. So he probably would have given out his private cell phone number to any and all sundry that needs to contact him. So... again, he gets a call saying, hey, you got to pick up this firearm that you haven't yet picked up. And they don't know, obviously, he's been dismissed. I mean, there's not this great communication per se. So on the 1st of August, he goes and picks up the firearm from the armory. And they're like, hey, Kakana, about time. Here you go. Here's the gun that we've told you to come pick up. They don't know the backstory. And essentially, he goes from there. At some point, he goes to the police station in the afternoon where he confronts the station commissioner and Captain Naidu. Now, what's interesting is there's a statement by Captain Naidu's sister about 2 weeks prior, where she says, like, you know, 2 weeks prior, my sister said she was very fearful for her life. There's someone who's facing a dismissal who makes her uncomfortable. She's concerned for her life. So we have a statement from Naidu's sister that 2 weeks before she'd had this interaction with her and she's worried. So we know that this was a persisting concern by Naidu at least. Now, whether there was other communications after that initial statement was given to open up the intimidation docket, we don't know.
This really illustrates why this concept of threat management and understanding threat is so critical and such a, you know, it is one of those aspects that is the more that we can incorporate this into policing, kind of as a preventative measure before the fit hits the shan, so to speak, the better. Just goes to show that there are kind of more modern, and you're the expert in this field, obviously.
So this is what we call an active shooter. Yeah. You know, we have ultimately two people shot, one dies, one thankfully survives. But, the third person, because the individual committed suicide, perhaps jumping ahead a little bit. So this was an active shooter scenario. It's a workplace violence active shooter, no different to when the ones you read about in the United States. Yeah. It just ended very quickly, and we'll get into how it played out exactly and maybe why it ended that quickly. But this was a mass shooting at a workplace, you know, and we don't often think of these things. I mean, perhaps you might have even heard of this case but not thought of it at one of these, but this was one of those scenarios. But like these scenarios that you read about in the United States, there were pre-incident warning behaviors, what we call leakage. There was the threats made to Naidu and this other person, threats against their life. And these should have been taken a lot more seriously than I believe they were. Because, yes, you've opened up an intimidation docket, but what are you doing about the safety of that individual?
Yeah.
You know, do we then say, for better or worse, we're going to say to Kakana, you know, you're going to work from home from now if he's not suspended? You know, what preventative protection steps? There were none.
Yeah.
Because we typically in South Africa think of, we open up a case and that's our solution. Open up a criminal investigation is not a solution to your safety.
Yeah.
Not at all.
No. No, it's not. I mean, it feels like this is the future of policing, isn't it? It's not quite, what was the movie with Tom Cruise? You know, where they do the future, they have the future crimes department. But it is very much, I mean, the more and more data that we have access to, the more and more kind of statistical analysis that we can do, the more we should be able to enter these types of threats into a system that then kind of spills out the risk factor that's involved there.
Yeah.
And you know, the more we can do to do preventative policing, like I say, it does feel like the future of policing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Just to also give a sense of where Kakana was at, just generally in his life as well. He was 38 at the time of the shooting, so he's not a kid. He's a mature adult. He's been with the police for 9 years.
Yeah.
So he's been, you know,
married,
think instilled with the values of the police for a decade, married, two children. So, you know, he's got a life. And
no violence history, no convictions. I mean, we don't know, he might have done other things, but he's no convictions. So, again, we have this, maybe this perception in our minds, what is someone who might commit a mass shooting? And again, what are we basing that on? But there's no profile of, you cannot say, well, this person doesn't match what we typically see. Because A, in South Africa, these are not typical crimes. We've had very few. We had Tempe Military Base in 1999, where a lieutenant was angry about something, booked out, got hold of an R4 assault rifle, and went on a rampage. I think he killed about 6 people, if I recall correctly.
You see, it's not the profile of the person that you need to look at. It's the behavior, isn't it?
100%. So we typically say, if you're looking at, well, does this person match what we typically see? No. Okay, he's not a risk. You're endangering people's lives. We always, when we assess threats, look at behavior.
Exactly.
Behavior tells us what to be worried about.
Not that his dad was a police officer for his whole life and he's a lovely man and he coaches the under-11s on a Saturday morning. No.
You know, because we've had that guy, Chipa Matiane from Kagiso Police Station, fantastic cop by all accounts, ended up committing a mass murder, going to different locations, killing people, family members, friends, work colleagues at the one police station, and then ultimately died at the end of that day. He wasn't what you would think. So anybody can be potential workplace violence, not as a mass shooter, but even just doing something violent in the workplace on a smaller scale.
Yeah. But the thing that can be a guide, like we say, then are the behaviors.
Yeah,
what
absolutely.
They're doing. All right, do we want to unpack the actual incident and kind of go into a little bit of detail there?
So we have a statement from the armorer says that he contacted him on the 1st of August 2011, about this pistol. It wasn't the first time he contacted him, but I guess Kakana maybe at that point previously thought, well, screw this, I'm not going to be doing my, again, I don't know if he was suspended, I can't recall particularly, but definitely he's contacted again on the day of the shooting. Hey, dude, you haven't picked up this pistol again. He contacted him, he says in his statement, I'd contacted him a month previously about it also. He didn't respond, but only on the 1st of August, when I phoned him again, he pitches up and picks up the firearm. He doesn't indicate what time of the day that was. So whether Kakana, in the back of his mind, had been thinking, I want to do this, or, you know, fantasizing about it. But I guess maybe on that day you realize, why not?
It does make you question how much the phone call saying, come and get this firearm, was a catalyst for the actual action.
Yeah. We know he'd threatened harm, because I'm pretty sure that those SMSs were him or his buddy. Yeah, I have very little doubt about that. So whether it was just like, I'm now in that state of mind, I have been told I'm going to be dismissed on a couple of days before, bugger it, you know? Yeah. Which is sad, because he still had a lot to live for. He had a wife, two kids, you know? Yeah. You know, the getting fired from your job doesn't mean you can never get another job.
No, exactly. Again... Were there potential further ramifications for him? He'd been let go. Was he facing a potential prison term? Were there further repercussions that he was concerned about?
You know, I can't recall whether there had been a fraud docket opened up. But, I mean, the amount was so little that even if he was convicted for 470 Rand fraud, you're not going to jail.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
What I mean? You weren't even a cop. You know, yeah. You might say, well, if it's a cop, we might be more inclined to say, there must be very serious consequences because of the position you had. Yeah. He was an admin clerk. So he wouldn't have gone to jail even if they bothered to prosecute him. And quite frankly, I would have just said, look, let's just get him out of the organization. We don't care. It's 470 Rand.
Yeah.
We're going to waste the court's time with this. So it's not like he's going to go to jail.
Kind of thing you can dust yourself off and pick your life back up. But it's not ideal.
Yeah, it also shows you can't say, well, because this is a minor thing, something tragic might not happen.
It's not lost on me that the victims are women.
Yeah, both. Yeah, in this case, both.
Now, in South Africa, unfortunately, my mind immediately goes to the root, to the fact that he's a man. These are women disciplined, essentially creating this problem for him. It does seem that the door is often more easily opened when it's a power imbalance where maybe a man's ego is being also knocked a little bit by the fact that he's being disciplined by a woman. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of conjecture, but it does feel like that was maybe a factor.
Mm. Could be, yeah.
Okay, let's carry
on. So we've got now the two people's statements from this case file that are perhaps of relevance would be Captain Stain, who was, I think, in charge of visible policing in for that station, and the actual Colonel Mkhize, who survived the shooting. You know, the two. I mean, I feel very, very. I mean, there must have been a horrific event.
Okay, so here it is. Lieutenant Colonel Mkhize's description was as follows: he entered with the firearm in his hand, already cocked. He pointed the firearm and said, "Why did you do this?" Then the first shot and then a second shot were heard. Then left the office and went to Naidu and fired four shots. Mkhize went to the door of her office and the suspect re-entered her office. She backtracked, trying to reason with him.
And she had already been hit at that point at least once in the chest.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
He then fired more shots. Captain Stain entered. The suspect stopped, looked towards Stain, committed suicide, shot himself.
Yeah. And sort of Stain's, not version, but his thing is, you know, he left a couple of minutes early, asked permission because he had to go pick up some pills at the pharmacy. And he kind of gets down the block and he gets a phone call. You know, there's shooting taking place. He rushes back. He says it took him about 2 minutes to get there, parks in front of the station, saw lots of people kind of standing in the street. He drew his Z88 9mm pistol, ran inside. He saw policemen standing around the sort of station commissioner's office outside, the pistols drawn. He goes inside. First, you know, obviously doesn't know what's going on. He kind of points his firearm around. Mm. He hears the station commissioner saying, "No Kakana, no Kakana," from the inside. So he comes in. And obviously he's sweeping the area with his firearm. He's like, "No, Stinky," because I guess she's worried that she might get shot again. Yeah. And essentially, you know, as you pointed out, that's when the suspect sees this and realizes, you know, and puts the gun to his head and shoots himself.
Yeah.
And he says he goes into the Naidu's office and sees her lying, you know, on the ground. She's still breathing. He holds her head. He waits while the paramedics arrive, he does CPR. I mean, it must have just been from Kize, obviously horrible. She's the victim of the shooting. But for Steyn to come in here and find his station commissioner and Naidu that he knows well, Kakana, shooting himself in the head right in front of him. I mean, the trauma, I think these poor people all around must have been horrific for these individuals.
And let's remember, guys, this is Rosebank.
Yeah, you know, an upmarket area.
For folks that don't know Rosebank, it is, I mean, in Johannesburg, probably the two most upmarket areas are Sandton and then Rosebank, and they're very near to each other.
And it's a tiny police station. You know, if you go to Sandton, it's a huge police station. Yeah, Rosebank is, I mean, it used to be my station. It's tiny. It's very intimate.
Surrounded by very upmarket hotels, residential, and businesses.
And everybody would have known each other very, very well. It's really tiny, tiny, tiny. And ironically, in the years later that I had to go to that police station, the office where Naidu now sits, the station commissioner's office is still the station commissioner's office. The office where Naidu was sitting where the shooting took place is now the firearms officer's, ironically. Office still is to this day. And I once said to him, do you know what happened here? And he's like, oh, yeah. Very intimate little police station. It really is very, very tiny. And I think, you know, again, kudos to Captain Steyn, who goes into a situation, into a room where he knows there's been shots fired, not knowing what he's walking into. And I think that's testimony to the bravery, not just of Steyn, of police officers in general, that you run towards the shooting. You don't run away from it like civilians who have the luxury of running away. Your job is to run towards. And, you know, for every cop who has to do that into a situation where he doesn't know what's going on, doesn't know if they're going to survive by himself pretty much in that scenario. And we forget about that. And this, he knew the people, you know, that's one element. But typically your job as a cop, you don't know these people. You don't know if the person you're going to run towards helping is a bad person or a good person in their life. But you're risking your life to actually save other people's lives. So just kudos to those people to do that.
What is then the kind of immediate aftermath of the shooting?
So we have, you know, Mkhize fortunately survives the incident. Naidu, I think, was shot, I think, four times, if I'm not mistaken. One of the questions which was looked into at the autopsy was Kakana under the influence of alcohol? Zero alcohol in his blood. So, you know, that not that that would have been an excuse or not, but, you know, we often know people do drink to give them a bit of courage. Totally sober at the time of the incident. Autopsies are done on Kakana, one gunshot wound to the head, and Naidu, I think, had a couple of shots to her. But my question, what changed after this? Nothing. The police would have just seen this as, this is a horrible incident. Not, hey, let's look at how we dealt with this as in general. Let's look at how we deal with threats towards our employees. Maybe we should have some kind of a different way of dealing with threats. And I can tell you now, as an ex-cop myself who had received threats, it's kind of seen as, but it's your job.
Yeah.
Yes, you can open up a case and we'll investigate it, but it's your job to get threatened as a cop.
Yeah.
And when I told my general about threats that I received, in the Andrea Fenter case, which we've spoken about before, it was kind of like, yeah, so? That's why we give you a gun and a bulletproof, and cops get threatened. If we have to try and do something every time a cop is threatened, well, you know, they'll paralyze the organization. So we don't deal very well.
And that feels very old-fashioned, doesn't feel like a very modern approach to it.
You know, it's like, you're suck it up, you're a cop, dude.
Yeah.
That's really...
Look, there's also the aspect that if they'd kind of looked back at the incident, it's, you know, very much in relation also to who has access to firearms, who is not necessarily a trained police officer. It seems odd to me that Kakana has access to weapons, like you say, without... And is not a trained officer, therefore has not gone through kind of appropriate firearms training.
Does he have firearms competence?
Now, if you have access to a firearm to because typically you're kind of assigned it to utilize as part of your daily task, you've got the gun. If you've got to go pick up a broken gun that you've just had repaired from the, you know, from wherever
the armory,
it is,
yeah.
and It's exactly the same thing, essentially, isn't it? You've got a gun in your pocket.
Yeah.
Either and way.
I never worked at a station, so I don't know whether that's how it is normally, that admin clerks have access to firearm safes. I would be surprised at that, because, again, I think in terms of the Firearms Control Act, if you're going to be handling, whether it's even transporting, do you have firearms competency?
Exactly.
At a minimum. So I don't know. I'm hesitant to say that that wasn't policy and procedure.
Because any time that you're carrying, handling, transporting a firearm anywhere, you are a target.
Yeah. But does this mean that even, let's say, for example, you don't have any access to firearms legally?
Yes.
Does that mean you wouldn't still have had a violent incident? No. You can grab a gun off your colleague and run and shoot him and run into the station commissioner's office. You could stab the person.
You could source an illegal firearm.
You know what I mean? Legal firearm, or maybe a licensed firearm that you as a civilian would have had. So, yes, the firearm is important, but we cannot only focus. Like the Primrose school shooting recently where that kid took his dad, a 13-year-old primary school kid took his dad's gun and shot someone, the principal at school. Yes, firearms control is important, but you cannot do that at the expense of saying we're not going to look at the angry individual who wanted to go and kill someone. You have to look at both. And purely taking the firearm out of the equation does not mean you're not going to have a violent outcome. And that's what I just always want to highlight.
But this is that kind of debate that you hear a lot when it comes to, for example, gun legislation in America, is the fact that, you know, there seems to be this disconnect between the fact that if somebody has the potential to do something deadly with a firearm, there's less likelihood of it happening if it's harder for them to get their hands on a firearm. The easier it is for them to get their hands on a firearm, the more likelihood that it could potentially happen.
Yeah. Well, happen with greater lethal consequences. You know, I mean, that guy still, we've had cases, people using swords, knives, homemade bombs, a brick, their hands, their fists. You know, so there are still ways that the person who's determined to commit harm towards another human being is not going to go, oh, I wish I had a gun, now I can't do anything. You know, you will downscale to with what you have access to.
I agree that people should have the rights to have a gun. I don't personally think that, you know, who is anyone to tell me that I can't legally own and handle a firearm? Mm. To me, it's all about how accessible these things are and, you know, what you have to go... If you've gone through a process that's considered, that you're going through appropriate training, then why shouldn't anyone anywhere in the world have a firearm? The problem always seems to be when people can get a firearm who shouldn't be able to get one that easily.
Or like access to one. Like, you know, that kid from Primrose should never have, his father's firearm should have been locked in a safe when only the father has access to the keys or on the father's person. So yes, and I'm a fool. I mean, if you've unfortunately behaved in a way where you've not complied with the law, you should be punished. So the father potentially should have criminal charges against him in the same way that the child should have criminal charges against them. But the problem is people then want to say, instead of applying the law and punishing the people who didn't do something right, we need to take away more firearms rights. We need to reduce people's... And I'm like, but then you're punishing the law-abiding citizens for the criminals who've done something wrong with a firearm. And I have a problem with that, personally. I mean, you might disagree with me. You're totally welcome to disagree with me. So I think we've got a pretty good Firearms Control Act. You know, it's one firearm that you have to justify for self-defense. You have to go through a competency program, training, testing of your knowledge of the law and how to handle firearms, like a driver's license, before you can even apply for a firearm. But if people don't abide by the law, they should be punished. And if you are negligent with your firearm, you shouldn't have one. It should be taken away from you. You should be charged criminally, and you never have license to a firearm again. But unfortunately, you get elements who want to use anything to try and restrict firearms ownership for sporting, collecting, private ownership. And you never get firearms rights back. The minute they're chipped away, you don't get them back. So we have to be very careful about, is this a case of the law wasn't applied properly? People didn't behave properly and they should be punished versus let's just take away more rights.
Yeah.
And we have to be very careful about a government that wants to make sure civilians have no access to firearms. That is usually, and I sound very dramatic when I say this, in other countries that had a tyrannical streak amongst them, like Nazi Germany, that was the first step.
Yeah.
So just we have to be very cautious. And you might think, oh, we're being conspiracy theorists. Just be careful.
I think, though, I mean, what seems to happen in the kind of broader general conversation and Again, I kind of refer a lot to America here because you do see a lot of these types of shootings, and a lot of the discussion is often around how easily accessible kind of firearms were, and these guys have gone and bought these
and they shouldn't be
really military grade weapons and then gone and wiped out a school kind of thing.
So I agree with that. Firearms should never be easily accessible. I mean, I'm a supporter of firearms. I own a couple of firearms. I do sports shooting. But I don't want every person to have access to firearms. I don't want every idiot. I think the majority of people should never have their hands on a firearm legally or otherwise. Yeah. So I'm a full supporter that there should be strict conditions. And in South Africa, you could only have one handgun for self-defense, and you have to motivate why you need it for self-defense, which, okay, in South Africa isn't too difficult to motivate because of police response times and our crime rates. And that you have to abide by that very strict law. Safe has to be installed, mounted, bolted to the wall, has to be SABS compliant. Only on you, or it's in a safe, that's it, and only you have access to it. And I'm a full supporter of strict, and like I said, I like firearms, but I definitely feel the majority of society should never own one. So I'm all for them. I think most responsible firearms owners also agree with those, that there should be strict control and access, and you shouldn't be able to walk in and walk out with a shotgun rifle, semi-automatic firearm again. So
maybe what doesn't happen is that we also need to take into consideration the kind of social and cultural context, especially of the time. For example, there's the is it the which amendment in America is it that gives you the, is it the Second Amendment?
Second Amendment
that gives you the right to bear arms as a civilian, is it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
So, but that's kind of entrenched in the American Constitution that you have the right to a firearm, which is now the reality. However, is that we live in quite a different world from when the Constitution was written. When the Constitution was written, you were living on a farm somewhere in Middle America, and you were concerned about, you know,
the British invading you again,
exactly,
and taking
or
over
tribal conflicts states, or whatever, yeah. Exactly. So, whereas today we have all the access to the technologies and other preventative measures and other alternative options to firearms that. It should be, there should be better, stricter processes in place today to access a firearm. I agree that people shouldn't be stripped of the right altogether, but we should be applying the technology, the ability to manage information that we have, thanks to all of the kind of, you know, the technology that we're surrounded by. We should be applying that more and more, and maybe it's an unwillingness or it's expensive to do these things. There are other priorities. You know, it is a lot to police and manage, isn't it? And that feels like maybe it is, you know, just people don't want to kind of commit to how complicated the administrative task can be.
But look, I mean, that's a whole can of worms. And, you know, it's not in our Constitution, so we can't say it's a right in terms of our Constitution. But if you actually read that Second Amendment from the United States, it says a well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state. Remember, they came from having just kicked out the Brits. Yeah. The right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. Now, of course, people interpret that different to mean the individual, or do they mean that there's a right for militias, which is like a quasi-civilian armed populace, organized populace of some form or fashion,
kind of
like. Which back then, you know, we, yeah, anyway. But it's not a right, it's not a constitutional right in our country.
Sure. Okay.
And we have to definitely be very careful about when government wants to say, like Bate Taylor did say a year or two ago, I don't think any civilian should own a right for a handgun or a firearm for self-defense. And I think the majority of people said, whoa. You guys can't protect us. You can't respond within less than 40 minutes to a 911 call, 10111 call. We have increasingly high crime rates, and you're telling us you guys don't need a gun and we'll protect you.
Yeah.
If you said, we're going to get that crime rate down comparable to any kind of Western country, you know, Denmark, Sweden, UK, and then you say to me, Gerard, you don't need to own a firearm for self-defense, I'd say, yeah, you're probably right, I don't. Maybe still for sports, if I'm a sports shooter or a collector or whatever other criteria, or a hunter. But yes, if I lived in England, I wouldn't feel the need to have a firearm for self-defense because you've secured my society that really is not a justifiable reason. But first do that and then say to me, guys, from now on, we're not going to issue self-defense licenses. If it goes up again beyond a certain percentage, we're going to start, you know, the agreement is we'll start issuing self-defense licenses. But if we get it below, you know, 5% murder rate in the country, whatever the comparable to other countries, those are very stable, then yeah, I'd be quite happy to say, sure, I'll give up any self-defense firearm I have because I don't need it to protect myself.
Look, it does seem, if we're talking about the UK, it does seem, however, that violent crime with weapons, not necessarily guns, but certainly knife crime, seems to be a very serious
concern. That's the next level concern,
and,
yeah.
And a really kind of... a problem, yeah. That becoming more and more of a problem in the UK.
And in the UK, you can't walk around with a pocket knife. Like, no. I walk around with a knife. Just, I've always had a knife in my pocket, folding knife, etc., or a little Swiss Army knife. You can't do that in the UK. I think that beyond a blade of, like, what's it, I think 2 centimeters or two inches, you can't have a knife in you, on your person.
And yet knife crime is on the rise. It also kind of, you know, it comes back to that, like, it makes you think about that, you know, with a kid, you know, it's like you tell them they can't do something, it's going to happen more, you know.
Yeah. So complex issues, and we have to be just very careful about the decisions that are made that we support about firearms.
That said, it doesn't seem appropriate that somebody of civilian non-rank in a police environment where they could access firearms training if need be, better than anyone, pretty much any other organization, shouldn't, by the sounds of it, have access to handling weapons.
I mean,
and not have the keys to the gun safe.
What happens if Kakana went to go pick up an R5?
Exactly.
Or had access to the safe where there's an R5?
No, it could very
and,
easily
you know,
have been.
SAPs R5s are fully automatic. Not that automatic you shoot accurately, but it, I mean, the thing is, it's a high, you know, 5.56 caliber, you know, round. Does a lot of damage. Not that I'd want to be shot with either a 9mm or a 5.56. So, you know, he could have had access to something that could have been far more lethal in terms of, you know, magazine capacity, for example, or distance to that he could shoot and accurately kill people, etc. So, yeah.
It is very strange. Let's just maybe consider some of the psychology here. It's very strange that you feel so disgruntled about how your life has been affected and your choices then to end your life, essentially. That you are so enraged and you feel so hard done by that you're willing to give up your life for that cause.
Yeah, that's a very tragic end for so many reasons that Kakana felt that was the best solution.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're not just losing your job here. You're losing your whole existence.
And not even just, say, committing suicide. You know, killing other people and then committing suicide.
Of course. Interesting that we don't, and I'm glad we don't, but interesting we don't see more of these types of... Yeah. It feels like, you know, there seem to be a lot of these types of mass shooting incidents, again, in a country like the USA. It does seem like, you know, we've got a whole range of, you know, we've got a whole bouquet of different crimes that are
and lots of them
happen a lot in South Africa. But these types of walk into an environment where there are lots of people and open fire
doesn't seem
to happen that often here.
Yeah. So we've had like your tavern shootings, but that is more gang sort of related. We went through a spate of those about a year or two ago, specifically in KZN, I think. But this old-fashioned, disgruntled person who wants the active shooter that you think of in your mind of the United States, a guy going to a school, going to a workplace, and pissed off about something and killing a bunch of people, we haven't had a lot of. Like I said, 1999 was in Tempe Military Base. We had another one, I think, in 2001 on a smaller scale in Tempe Military Base. This one in Rosebank Police Station in 2011. Trying to think off the top of my head a few others. You know, the Sizzlers one was a robbery gone wrong with two robbers. But you just haven't had a lot of them. And I'm quite amazed that we haven't had more.
Yeah, I seem to recall in the past, me and you have discussed this somewhat, and you've suggested that perhaps we kind of get all our violence out in the general crime, that it doesn't kind of build up, and then I'm going to go to a cinema.
Yeah, and snap and do a whole bunch of, well, snap at the right thing.
Just people can kind of vent their anger as they go kind of thing. So.
Yeah. So do we just react out sooner as South Africans? We don't wait. We don't bottle things up.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
We don't spend months on the internet ordering weapons and storing up all this resentment and anger and frustration and then unleash it at one time. It happens more consistent. We do it over a more consistent
on a smaller scale, yeah. We can't wait, yeah.
Yeah. What are your, you know, what are, you say that like there was nothing really kind of markedly that you could point at that was a positive outcome of this, you know, from a threat assessment point of view or what have you. What can we take from this case?
Well, I think we have to, and workplaces in general, have to take threats more seriously, have to then implement steps to protect their employee. Here, opening up an intimidation docket to investigate it was not the solution to keeping people safe. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Because let's say you did identify Kakana as the guy who sent those SMSs. Now you're also going to have an additional criminal case, or at least now another a criminal case against him for the intimidation. Do you think you're making, if you look at what ultimately happened, would that have made the situation safer or worse?
Yeah.
You're adding to the person's troubles in the world. So that's why this is not a solution to keeping people safe. You know, Kakana for the intimidation docket was not going to go to jail for the rest of his life, so that you couldn't even say you would be removing him from circulation for a number of years to keep people safe. So we have to respond in a way of, okay, we have an employee who's feeling unsafe. What have you done to make her feel safe? What have we done to try and structure things that, you know, we can make sure this person is less likely to be exposed to harm? Do we intervene in a different way? Do we allow her to work from home? You know, do we say to Kakana, even if he's not suspended, okay, dude, we'll just, you're going to work from home. I'm giving you paid leave to go sit on your butt at home. Don't let him access back into the police station. You know, Naidu, what's going to make you feel safe? What would work for you? Maybe give you, or at least we know there was threats. We're coming up to the point of this guy being dismissed, so that's going to be an increased concern point in time, a trigger point. How are we going to make sure that Naidu is safe? Because she's received the threat and the other person who received the threat for that time period until we know things have calmed down. So there are things you can do, but we have to have a workplace violence threat prevention attitude. And this is not what you see here.
It does seem like the place to kind of instill this concept is in the private sector. Mm. That, you know, this is not a million miles away from the receptionist at your office.
Yeah.
She's broken up with her boyfriend. Absolutely. And he's been sending her death threats. And the potential is there for this kind of incident to happen. And, you know, perhaps then there's an opportunity for those listening to understand that in your working environment, you know, there are organizations. One, for example, I would Google if you're in these kinds of issues, LNS Threat Management, a good one.
Definitely.
You know, but there are, you know, it does seem like a way that maybe they could be kind of instilled as a solution that then kind of bleeds into other areas like policing and what have
you. So assess the threat, determine what the concern is, what the level of risk is, and then develop a strategy for managing it.
Yeah.
We don't see the opening up intimidation docket is not a threat assessment and management response at all. It actually is making the situation worse.
Yeah. But it could be, it feels like it could be a very a standard component of a private company.
So in all, like in the States, in all companies above a certain size, I think they have to have threat assessment and threat management structures, or at least access to people who can advise on those cases.
Nothing like, and there's nothing, no requirement here.
Not at all.
What kind of organizations here do you find that would have a threat assessment? What sectors are you kind of the most futuristic when it comes to this?
Well, in terms of, because this is what I do as a living now, and definitely my biggest clients are people in like the banking sector. And probably because you mess with people's money, people get very angry. And we see that when people's accounts are frozen because they didn't FICA them or RICA them or whatever. Yeah. Or when an insurance payout isn't made because they feel the person doesn't have a valid claim. We had one recently where a guy phoned the call center and said, well, I'm going to come there and shoot up a bunch of people and kill myself because you didn't pay out my disability claim.
Yeah.
Okay, we can't just ignore that. You know. So the bank responded. We went to meet this person, interview them, get a better idea of what's dealing with, and develop a strategy for preventing that harm from taking place. So definitely the financial sector, whether it's insurance to banking. But we get a lot, like you say, the domestic violence issues. And that you can get in any sector. You can be in nursery school. And like you say, if one of the teachers has an idiot of an ex-boyfriend who's possessive and jealous and comes to her place of work and screams and shouts and threatens and accuses you of having an affair with her, that's why she's broken up with her. That's a huge concern is the workplace violence, is the domestic violence issue.
Would you be able to go, here's a, you know, is there, does there exist anywhere like a set of guidelines? Like, here are 20 rules or 10 rules that if you start to see some of these patterns or these behaviors, then you have a potential real risk on your hands here.
Yeah. What we try to say to companies is you need to have a basic policy in your company that Anytime someone feels unsafe based on something that was said, done, whether it's a customer, client, vendor, fellow employee, that is brought to the attention of person X, whose job it is to look into that and see what is the actual backstory, or is there more information that we didn't know about? Maybe other people are being bothered by this individual, mm-hmm. but just didn't mention it, and then assess what we're dealing with and a strategy for the way forward. So that's essentially the first problem, is bringing these things to the attention of somebody in the company. And that's somebody who has the training and mandate to look into it further to determine assessing the problem. In other words, it's the identification of it is the first issue, the assessment of it along the proper principles of threat management, and then deciding on the management strategy of how we're going to approach that. And yeah, I mean, it starts with the policy. It starts with having trained people to assess threats and a company buy-in that, yeah, we're going to manage these things because you want to keep our people safe and happy and productive.
So in lieu of there being a solution that is, oh, just phone the police and tell them you're being threatened, show them the SMSs you're getting from your ex-boyfriend, in lieu of that being a practical solution, what do you advise then? What kind of solutions do you advise people to put in place if they're going through this kind of thing, for whatever reason they're receiving violent or whatever kinds of threats from somebody?
The police is never a response, because what you'll get is, well, okay, he's threatened you, so that's criminal injuria maybe, so, and that docket. Again, if you have someone who's angry at you, opening up a criminal case against them, I can absolutely freaking guarantee you is going to make them more angry. Now, yeah. That's not to say don't do it, but do not think that that's a solution to keeping you safe. No. Protection order. I mean, think about it. You have an angry ex-boyfriend who's threatening the girl, throwing a brick through a window. Now you get a protection order saying, stop doing these bad things. That person is not going to, A, abide by it, very likely, and B, doesn't give a damn. He already knows he's not supposed to be doing that. Yeah. So now you've dragged him into the courtroom for a protection order. Yeah. He's going to be more angry. So it's about getting the appropriate people to advise you on how concerning your situation is. Now, that's a problem when you're an individual lady and you've got an ex-boyfriend or husband who's threatening you. You know, who do you go to get that advice? But, of course, how do you implement that safety program? So that's why we tend to focus on corporates, because they typically have internal security. They have lawyers who might advise legally. They have close protectors who they have contract with security companies. So it's much more, that's why I tend to not get involved on the individual level and focus on the corporate level, because the recommendations you make, the company has the resources, whether it's financial or otherwise, to implement them. That's why, don't get involved
in
cases where
you individually
are.
You're saying, unfortunately, if there's not an obvious answer to this, it means that there's not an obvious solution to it. I mean, that's kind of scary, isn't it? To think that as an individual, there's not a lot of basic advice we can give you.
There's advice, but
apart
how it's
from
going to be implemented.
Go get an assessment done. But then even the assessors find it difficult on an individual level to say, this is a surefire way to minimize this threat down to kind of it being negligible.
Mm. Yep.
Scary.
That's why I do stay away from individuals. Sorry, guys, if you're thinking of phoning me because your
boyfriend's
threatening you.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm usually happy to give some thoughts over the phone, but because you unfortunately become the person, he's outside my door right now. What do I do? Because who else do I phone? And that's obviously, I'm not a security company.
Yeah. It's a tough one, eh?
In an ideal world, when laws for law enforcement worked well and we had anti-stalking laws and protection orders worked well, there's more of a state solution to your problem. But unfortunately, South African police still think, but he hasn't done anything yet. He's threatened to kill me. Yeah. He's outside my... walking up and down my sidewalk with a baseball bat. Well, he hasn't done anything yet.
I guess make sure that your security at home is as tight as you can possibly make it. Have some kind of an option for an immediate threat response, whether it's with a private security company or what have you. But yeah, I mean, I could say there's not a lot of advice then. I mean, if Jared can't give you advice on
I'm
this, then
to give it
I don't know who can. No, for sure. All right. Well, I mean, we talk about crime, so we can't always end a podcast feeling kind of feeling bright and cheery, can we? I mean, it's not an ideal circumstance that we find ourselves in. I guess as a public, you know, there's elections coming up. It's about kind of changing. We've got to change the big, change the big problems, and once those start to shift, then it'll hopefully all filter down to all this kind of detail and all these.
What you can do is in your workplace, ask your company, what are you going to do about if I get threatened? Even if it's by my ex-boyfriend, but he comes to my workplace, you can't turn around at me and say, that's your private problem, Gerald, sort it out. Because I'm an employee who's on duty. If that boyfriend kills me on the workplace, it's the workplace's problem. So start pushing in your work environment.
There you go.
And there was, you know, the code of good practice for preventing violence and harassment, or preventing harassment in the workplace, that came out about 2 years ago from the Department of Labor. And their definition of harassment actually is workplace violence. So say, right, guys, here's this policy, here's this code. What have you done to implement this code? Yeah. How do you keep me safe in the workplace? Even if the problem comes from my personal life. What are you doing to keep me safe in the workplace? So pushing the workplace is important.
Well, there you go. I think that's a good place to start. And if you're pushing your workplace, like I say, I mean, get hold of LNS Threat Management and see how they can advise you guys on what kinds of solutions you can have in place in that environment. Gerard, you know, final thoughts on this case?
Tragic. Was it preventable? I think they could have done more.
Certainly.
Which hopefully might have derailed this person from going down that pathway. Can't say 100% sure it was preventable. Hopefully the SAPS has looked at certain things, like who does have access to firearms.
Yeah.
But again, you can get a policeman who could have done the same thing too. So, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like, I think there's cases that tragic, but I think there are teaching cases, which is why it's nice to talk about this. And I talk about this on my own training on workplace violence issues. And we do have these things, you know, that the first thing is to say we actually do have these cases. Yeah. This is not just an American thing.
Look, the reality is that you can be a serving police officer in what you would think is one of the safest, most well-policed environments, that these types of threats can be mitigated against. But even there, you're not 100% safe. So be aware and be, you know, if you're finding yourself in a situation where you are being threatened, be aware of what environment you're a part of, what institutions you have access to, what institutions you work with that can possibly assist you.
And don't ignore warning signs.
You know, help you through that challenge, you know?
Don't ignore threats.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Don't say it's part of the job.
Take violent threats seriously.
Don't you yourself say, ugh, this
don't
is
dismiss
nothing.
It.
Don't get the opinion of people.
I know him. He would never go that far.
Until he does.
I've known him for 10 years. He'd never do that. Yeah. Don't rest on your laurels in that regard.
You've known him for 10 years, but do you know who he is right now?
Yeah.
With his pressures and stresses.
No, exactly. All right, Gerald, thank you very much. We'll be back again soon, folks. I'd be very interested to hear, you know, examples of incidents that people have been through where they've maybe had a positive outcome, you know, found a way in their circumstance to resolve the matter. Also, you know, where these things have maybe spiraled out of control and there's been a problem that, you know, people couldn't necessarily overcome. You know, I'd be interested to hear. Please feel free to share any of those stories and we can possibly talk about them on future episodes. Thank you, Gerard, as always.
Just in general, I'd love to hear from our listeners where you've had concerning threats made or harmful behavior in the workplace.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
Customers threatening you. Really interesting to hear about examples of that. Because that's an underspoken, underaddressed issue, yeah.
For sure.
And this was workplace violence.
For sure. All right, Gerard. Well, I think that about wraps up this case. The Rosebank police shooting, a tragic incident. Unfortunately, no winners when it comes to this one. And that includes the general public when it comes to kind of positive outcomes that might have been sparked as a result of this case. I guess the onus is on us to be ever vigilant. And like Gerard says, do not ignore threats. Take them seriously and find the right solutions for you. We'll be back with more episodes. You can spread the word about the show. Please do share Profiler with your friends, with your colleagues, anyone interested in crime, true crime in Africa or beyond. Visit us at youtube.com/C/ProfilerAfrica and do subscribe to the page. You can find us on Instagram @ProfilerAfrica. Or join our Facebook group. Drop us an email at profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. Get ready to explore crime scenes, sift through evidence picks, and confront images of perpetrators and victims. We'll put up some of the photographs related to this crime. So do have a look on the Instagram page, and you can see some of the stuff that we were talking about. Thank you very much, Gerard. As always, it's been great.
Okay, cool. Thanks, listeners, everything. Thank you for listening.
We will speak again soon, and rest easy, South Africa, and the world, I guess, if you're listening from somewhere else.